I got into this as a political cartoonist, as a pro, I got syndicated in 1991. There were about 350 full-time editorial cartoonists in the United States. That was way down. There used to be 2,000 a century ago. But today there's about 16.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thank you for joining us to discuss the future of satirical cartooning. I am Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are extremely honored to have with us a man whose bad boy reputation precedes him. I speak, of course, of Ted Rall, a living, kicking cartoonist who's here to talk about the role and craft of the political cartoonist. So let me begin first with a Ted Rall quote. Political cartooning may not pay well, or often at all, and media elites can ignore it all they want, but it matters, almost enough to die for. Ted Rall is a syndicated cartoonist whose work appears in 100 newspapers around the United States. He draws 3 editorial cartoons a week, in addition to writing a weekly syndicated column. He's editor-in-chief of the satirical news website skewednews.net. In addition to his 4 successful pictorial biographies about Ed Snowden, Bernie Sanders, Trump, and now Pope Francis, he's written about topics as diverse as international politics, popular culture, privacy, and generational politics. I'm delighted to introduce the talented and always opinionated Ted Rall.
Thank you to the Cambridge Forum. It's awesome to be here. It's very exciting to sort of be back in where I began. I was born at Mount Auburn Hospital, and on a very hot day in late August 1963. Cambridge has a special place in my heart, not to mention all the used bookstores and the Mexican restaurants where certain departments of Homeland Security chiefs are not allowed to eat. So political cartooning is in trouble, but at the same time, it's very vibrant. I mean, cartooning arguably goes back to the cave drawings at Lascaux, France, and there are examples of political satire in pictorial form that go back to the Assyrian Empire that have been found, and no doubt most of this stuff was destroyed and lost, as no doubt most of my work will be by the after a few thousand years, if not sooner. What is going on with political cartooning in the United States today is kind of a perfect storm. Most political cartooning up until fairly recently was financed by and appeared in print media. Obviously, we all know what's happened to print newspapers, and they're in terrible trouble. In fact, I just saw a report that showed that print newspaper readership is declining currently at about 14 to 15% per year. And that's part of a long-term trend. I mean, newspaper readership has actually been declining since 1960. Television was really the first thing to start putting a dent in newspapers. And then for those of us who are old enough to remember, when many towns had multiple newspapers, a morning and an afternoon paper, at least in a typical American city. Now, peeking out, for example, in New York City in 1960, there were 28 daily newspapers. And today there are 3. And they're all in big trouble. The New York Times had to get a big loan from a somewhat disreputable billionaire a few years ago just to stay afloat. The Daily News is barely hanging on by a thread, owned by a Chicago-based company that I'm not very fond of called Tronc. The chaos in the world of print media is extreme. And then as if that's not bad enough, the few of us who are left are being targeted, some of my colleagues in France at Charlie Hebdo, with violence. That's happened in the United States, too. There was a gathering of right-wing political cartoonists in Garland, Texas, that was targeted by ISIS. It's an event that was kind of forgotten, but 2 ISIS gunmen showed up heavily armed and were shot at the entrance of this cartooning gathering a few years ago. You know, quite frankly, and I'm a little ashamed to say so, many of those of us on the left, of whom I count myself proudly, didn't have much to say about that. And that's still a threat to freedom of expression, even if it is against, in this case, racist cartoonists. Nevertheless, it's a scary time. And there's, when I got into this as a political cartoonist, as a pro, I got syndicated in 1991. There were about 350 full-time editorial cartoonists in the United States. That was way down. There used to be 2,000 a century ago. But today there's about 16, depending on how you count them. I'm one of them, the last of the Mohicans here. Believe it or not, at 55 years old, I will be in August, I'm one of the youngest political cartoonists in the United States. There's a far more vibrant political cartooning scene in, like, Iran, for example, or in there are far more of them in countries like Zambia. The United States is a country that has pretty much gone after this field and this profession pretty badly. And Rob Rogers at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, a friend, a colleague of mine, is the latest victim. And what's interesting about his case is that for the last 2 years since Trump took over, there's been a lot of fear that his rhetoric criticizing the media as fake news was going to lead to censorship within the media. But the truth is that we haven't really seen that censorship among traditional liberal news outlets until the case of Rob Rogers. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is an interesting paper. It's historically a Democratic paper. Its editorial page has been historically liberal and pro-union. And until fairly recently, if people remember Richard Mellon Scaife, he owned a paper in the town of Greensburg, Pennsylvania, which is near Pittsburgh. And they changed their name to the Pittsburgh Union Review. Scaife poured millions of dollars into this newspaper to try to take over the Pittsburgh market and turn it into sort of the Fox News in print of Pittsburgh. What's interesting is he failed. The paper ended up having to withdraw its circulation and distribution from the metro Pittsburgh area and crawled back like a wretch into the rock of Greensburg. But so the Pittsburgh Post Gazette remained as the proud victor, the liberal victor in this newspaper war. And yet, in the end, the right wing triumphed. The old publisher, who also publishes the Toledo Blade, which is a very conservative paper, made a political decision 2 years ago to shift the paper to the right. He said, well, Trump won, so that's now the new paradigm of American politics. So we need to switch our editorial page over to the right. So he brought in a guy from Toledo, editorial director, to basically serve as Rob's hatchet man. And in basically probably the most poorly handled firing that I've seen in my life, and you know, we live in America, people get poorly fired every day. I've been poorly fired myself, and I'm willing to talk about it if anyone wants to. He was like, first he went into, when the new guy came in, he showed him a cartoon. He's like, I don't like that cartoon, show me another one. I don't like that cartoon either, show me another one. Show me another one, show me another one. The editor killed 19 cartoons in a row, which was, he'd been working there for 25 years. Typically, he got one cartoon or two cartoons killed a year. This guy's doing, you know, 200 cartoons a year. So obviously, it was kind of like, well, I don't really like any of your cartoons. And instead of just saying, look, we're a right-wing paper now. Here's 2 years' salary. Thanks for your service. Goodbye. They just kind of were trying to get him to quit. And he had really no choice but to speak out, Rob did, because, you know, it's a newspaper and people are paying attention and suddenly he's not appearing and people are asking questions. So he did. And then it became this big national story. It's been all over CNN, the New York Times. And so what's really interesting is that today Rob Rogers is a more widely read cartoonist than he ever was at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Because when you're in the New York Times and on NPR and on CNN, people suddenly know you're alive. And so he's all over social media. He wasn't that great at social media before. He used to have a blog that had like three or four entries a year when you should really have three or four a day. The last time I checked, he did a cartoon online. It was like 11,000 retweets. Like, can I get fired like you? And you know, Charlie Hebdo is another example. I mean, unfortunately, nothing can bring back my colleagues, of whom I actually knew a few of them. But the paper is more vibrant than ever. Before the mass shooting in Paris, it was on the verge of bankruptcy. The paper was really on the way out. But now circulation is probably 5-6 times more than it was at the time. People are paying attention. And I think, you know, in this world of hyper-saturated, we're all reading a million apps, and there's so much media to consume. It's easy to forget that some legacy media stuff exists, and maybe we forget to appreciate it until it's gone, and we're like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened, and now it's gone. And that's kind of what happened with Rob. So what we have here with the Rogers parable is sort of the grim, you know, it's two sides of the same coin. This is about disruption. It's about print media going away and the online world taking over. So it's a really interesting world to live in. And I have to say, I do think that quote that Mary cited is important because it's an important medium. You know, I think there's no one here it would be insane to say, for example, that news reporting and analysis in words is no longer relevant and we shouldn't have anymore. No one would say that. Well, news analysis and commentary and satire in pictures is also an important distribution channel, and it does stuff that words can't do. And I do a column and I do cartoons because they both have different applications. They each have different purposes, they have different effects, and they do different things in the way that you can reach people. So I think the tricky part for people like me is to not become like NPR during Pledge Week. You know, like, it's not a guilt thing. It's not like, and when I used to be president of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, and one of the things that, like, my predecessors did, and some of my successors, has been like, you know, feel sorry for us. Like, we whined. Like, every time one of us was fired, we'd be like, it's so unfair. And I would be, that would make my skin crawl, because, like, you know, most Americans have lost their jobs unfairly at some point in their lives, or at least are close to someone who has. See, we're not special that way. Like, we're all suffering disruption. And so it's not that you should, like, read our cartoons or support our work or go to our GoFundMe pages because, like, you should feel sorry for us. It's because actually the work's really, there's, like, a lot of really interesting, cool work out there. With that, I guess I've blathered along enough, and I much prefer Q&A, and I promise to be nice, so.
Well, you are listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue our discussion of From Trump to the Pope, Inside the Mind of a Political Cartoonist with celebrated columnist and cartoonist Ted Rawl. Okay, I welcome people to come up with questions.
Couple quick questions. Is there a boycott being organized in the Pittsburgh area of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, as I hope there is? Secondly, have you considered doing a pictorial graphic biography of Julian Assange?
Okay, so in terms, I'm in touch with Rob. Surprisingly, a lot of cartoonists call me when they have a PR crisis. I can't imagine why that would be, but they do, and because I have a little experience in those matters. But I know there's been protests, and I know that certainly there's a lot of anger in the Pittsburgh community over what happened. So I think, you know, I mean, Rob's been playing this very well. He's exploiting this crisis as an opportunity, as he should. And it seems to be so far going well. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of people canceled their subscriptions. I don't know if it's an organized thing. So, Julie, in terms of doing a biography of Assange, he was my suggestion for my next book, and my publisher shot it down because, quite frankly, he's viewed on the left among liberals as kind of divisive, and there's some people who buy into, like, the Russiagate narrative who think that he played into that and, like, flipped the election. By the way, that's just not true. But there's, so Assange is a controversial figure even on the left in a way that Snowden really was a little controversial, but not as much. And so just, I mean, okay, so this sucks, right? Like, but, you know, this is the problem with capitalism. Like, if I lived in the Soviet Union, I could go to, like, Gorbachev and say, like, I would like to do a book about Julian Assange, and, you know, assuming that he knew who he was back then. And it's like, if it's approved, it's like, it becomes a guaranteed bestseller in state bookstores. But here, it's like, I've got to sell them. You know, and people often say, like, oh, why don't you do a book about this and that? And I'm like, well, because people have to go to stores and pay money and buy them. And, like, otherwise, like, I don't get any more books. I can do a book that I think is cool. I've done tons of, I've done 20 books. And some of them I did just because I thought they were cool. And then, like, after the cool book comes out and, like, it sold, like, nothing, the publisher goes, yeah, I lost, like, $40,000 on your cool book. So I'm never going to publish you again. So it sucks. It really does suck. If it were up to me, I'd do an Assange book tomorrow. If someone paid me the money to do it, I'd do it. But, like, I think my publisher is right. Like, liberals wouldn't buy it. Like, lefties would buy it. But liberals would, progressives would buy it.
If I ask a dumb question, am I going to wind up in a cartoon?
There are no dumb questions. There are only dumb people.
Okay. Here we go. With the demise of print, where do you suggest? I don't see political cartoons anymore.
Oh,
and you mentioned them popping up on your phone. I get people sending me cat videos and stuff, you know.
Well, you can always follow me on Twitter, and you will get cartoons sent directly to your phone. Twitter.com/Ted Rall. You know, it's true that, like my friends, one of my best friends is actually a conservative cartoonist at the Chicago Tribune, Scott Standis, and he was telling me how bummed he was that he speaks to college kids and they're like, oh, these are so cool. Wherever could we see them? And it's true that, like, they've vanished from a lot of places. I mean, in the digital space, you would really expect, for example, Huffington Post or, like, Slate or Salon or CNN.com or any number, you know, any newspaper or news or politics website, like Real Clear Politics, any of them to be running political cartoons. And yet they don't. I'm not really sure why. I think it's almost like they have to discover the power of the medium. I used to edit the cartoon section at Forbes, and it was like, I mean, objectively, you get more clicks from cartoons than you do from prose. You just do. And I'm saying this as a columnist. I do prose. I love prose. But it's so it's weird. It's just like they don't really know what they're doing in a way. But cartoons are out there if you want to find them. I mean, it's literally 60 seconds of, like, searches on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, and you will find them. There's zillions of them, and some of them are pretty good.
Hi, I wanted to ask about a lot of these magazines. They're probably left-leaning that seem like they have very interesting graphics, and I'm thinking of things like Jacobin, Current Affairs. Mm-hmm. Even The Baffler kind of has a lot of graphic things going on, yep. And I'm wondering, because people were sort of saying, the magazines are going out. But it seems like there's a kind of renaissance with these smaller magazines that really put a lot of effort into the artistic presentation of ideas.
Yeah, there are. It's for sure. I mean, political graphics have always been really important to Harper's, The Nation, The Progressive historically. But again, none of them are very good about hiring actual editorial cartoonists, and that's a shame.
Ted, have you been approached by or approached The Week?
I have approached The Week. They only print syndicated stuff, and I guess it's kind of a low-budget operation, actually, and they do run me from time to time.
Do you find your humor translates internationally?
You know, it's really interesting. The only real success I've had has been I've done comics journalism from Afghanistan and Central Asia, and those books received a lot of interest in Europe, particularly in Italy and France, and Germany, and I guess all the invadee countries. It's great. I mean, you're a rock star when you go to, like, Portugal to a comics convention or something. But I think there's something, even, like, you would really think that British stuff and American stuff would cross-pollinate a lot. And, like, Steve Bell is this brilliant cartoonist at the Guardian and a friend of mine. But you don't see his stuff here. I think it's too profane, and which is funny when you really think about it, because he's in England. But it doesn't make it here. And then American stuff doesn't really make it there. I've been, like, knocking on the Guardian America, you know, over and over. They don't even honor me with a rejection email. It's like it's hard to get that stuff overseas. And I mean, I'm biased, but I think Americans do the best political cartoons in the world. And I used to be a comics editor at a syndicate that handled international cartoons. And I still think that's true. I mean, there's a lot of cool work from other, but we're the best. I mean, it's kind of like look, action movies, like no one blows stuff up like Hollywood, and no one makes fun of politicians like we do. But it's
what about Private Eye?
Well, they're good. They're not, but we're better.
Oh,
sorry.
To agree to disagree there.
So, who are your favorite? Who are the ones you really like out there?
Well, so I came up in the alternative press, you know, papers like, not like the Boston Phoenix, because they never ran me, but I was in the Weekly Dig. You know, and I started out in like things like the Village Voice, the San Francisco Weekly, Washington City Paper, and stuff like that. Like, so I was like kind of side by side with people like Tom Tomorrow and Reuben Bowling, who, in my view, is the best cartoonist in America. You know, everybody should have... You should think you're good, because if you don't, like, why are you getting up in the morning and putting your stuff in the paper? But there should always be people you think are better than you. And, like, I think, like, Tom the Dancing Bug is, like, I hate him. He's smarter, funnier, and better than I am. And and you should really invite him, because he's great. And it'll be a better talk. And the room will be cooler. It'll be an open bar. It'll just be great. And he's... I Ward Sutton... Jen Sorensen, who does a strip called Slowpoke, Michaela Reed, who's a left-wing political reporter, Stephanie McMillan, who does Minimum Security, who's a crazy far-left revolutionary communist, awesomely hilarious cartoonist.
Okay, so we established that you're sort of an idealist.
Totally.
But you call yourself a subversive. So do you think that's really important to have in democracy, subversives?
If you know, there's always a dominant paradigm in any kind of society, and it relies on certain shibboleths that are some true, others not so true. And if you don't have a cast of people who are satirists and just social critics and activists and anarchists and people who are trying to undermine or criticize, like, you're never, first of all, that society can't be vibrant and can never even reform itself. But it's doomed, really, to revolution in the future. But even aside from that, if you don't have that, like, I think there's no hope for improvement in the future. I mean, the powers that be don't wake up in the morning and, like, you know, there's even, like, the, you know, like, Democrats in Congress, they don't wake up in the morning and think, holy, there's tons of people sleeping outside every night, and this is America. They don't give two blankety blanks. They don't care. They don't care. They might care in some abstracted way, but they don't care. Like the way you care, like when your bills are like unpaid. Like you care. It's so that's up to people, you know, that's up to us to raise hell and call their attention to this stuff. Otherwise, nothing's ever going to get better. Ever. I mean, honestly, it's like satirists and I'm not saying this about myself, although it's self-interested. I mean, I'm a fan of this medium that I'm in, and it has endless potential. I mean, can you imagine, for example, if, like, say, powerful media outlets like NPR and the New York Times and CBS News put, like people who were, like, on the far left critiquing society on the air and in print and in drawings routinely? It would broaden the conversation, and it would just, and on the far right, by the way. And it would just allow the full spectrum of ideas to be exposed and discussed. In fact, but instead we're in this like really narrow casted band of self-censored, bland, middle of the road, DNC, DLC, centrist, corporatist crap. And you know, it's not good for society. It's not even really good for, say, the Democratic Party. It's not even good for these media outlets. They're all leaving money on the table. They would have bigger. I guarantee you that print media wouldn't be in as much trouble today if it wasn't as boring.
So, a last question for you. As a cartoonist, can you ever go too far, and have you been guilty of doing something you wished you hadn't done? Is there a cartoon you regret?
Many. Ideologically, there is no way you can go too far, ideologically. I mean, if you can come up with a great Holocaust joke, you should make it. I personally don't know one, but if you can, you should do it. Art should, like, shoot for the stars. It's a high wire act. You should, like, be like Philippe Petit, going for gusto, make it happen, you know, and take risks. If you don't take risks, you're going to suck. But, you know, and then you're going to fall sometimes. And that's as it should be. But I think in terms of you're going to fall sometimes. And, you know, I think about, there's cartoons that I would just do over, a lot of them I would just do over just because of the execution, just could have been better. You know, it's like you're on a deadline and it's like, oh my God, like, oh, I forgot to do this. I should have done that. This could have been clearer. This drawing could have been better, whatever. But then there's, I think what you're getting at is more like stuff, issues of taste. Like,
should you ever pull one? Yeah.
Yeah, like for example, okay, so a classic example for me is the day that George W. Bush was reelected in 2004, I did a cartoon where I was trying to go for a metaphor. Metaphors are always dangerous. And I was trying to do, so I kind of had the American public as like, or the American society as a classroom. And I compared the classroom with like mainstreaming of disadvantaged kids. And basically I compared Bush as having been, as basically putting the mainstreamed kid in charge of the class. I mean, I wasn't thinking about like the kids. I was just thinking about how much I hated George W. Bush and what an idiot he was and how crazy it was that he had been reelected after like losing the war in Iraq, you know, and destroying the economy and just being, you know, legalizing torture and just generally being a bad person. The thing is, I started getting these complaints from parents and of disabled children. And I was like, oh man, like I screwed up big time. And then I made my second mistake, which is I issued a public apology and retraction. I will never do that again. I lost the Washington Post. They were holding tight. Everyone was holding tight with me until I apologized. Wow. Then they all threw me under the bus. And to, when Trump doesn't apologize, he's right. It's like in America, it's being apologizing is like foolish. It's like you should never apologize. It's the right thing to do, but not if you care about your career.
Oh.
So like, I think it was a, you know, it was bad. It was like, I'm not sorry I did, but I know that it was not like smart. And you should be able to screw up and be like, oh my God, I shouldn't have done that. Mm. And you should be able to be like, you know, my bad. I mean, we all screw up, we're humans. And, you know, I mean, and there's lots of other stuff like that. I mean, I did this very controversial cartoon about Pat Tillman where, you know, he was the football player who died in Afghanistan. Mm. And the mistake there, and I kind of corrected this in the future, was that like that in this cartoon I did, very controversial cartoon called Terror Widows, was that I kind of assumed that everybody watches as much news as I do. And that's just not true. People work like 50 hours a week. So if people understood the background, the cartoons would not have been very controversial, but they didn't understand it. So now one of the things I have to do as a cartoonist is tee up the story in the cartoon. I'll be like, so this happened, and then in the caption, and then I'll show like my response to it. When I started drawing cartoons as a teenager and then in my 20s, you didn't have to do that because everyone's just reading the same news. There's only four TV networks broadcasting news. If a story's big, everyone's heard of it. And if they're seeing it in a newspaper, the odds are they're familiar with the news. But that's not true anymore. Like now, a cartoon might just pop onto their cell phone and they don't have, and completely out of context, where someone's reading it who never reads the news. So you better have the news story in that cartoon.
Thank you very much, Ted. It's been wonderful. You have been listening to From Trump to the Pope, Inside the Mind of a Political Cartoonist, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with Ted Rawle, the celebrated cartoonist. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us, and please come again.